A whole gang of media snoopers, including Jonathan Marks, scans from D.C. to daylight every Thursday here on Radio Netherlands. Their super-duper whopper-doppler receiver gizmos pick out the essence of what's happening in the world of international broadcasting. Radio Netherlands, we have the technology.
Hello, this is Jonathan Marks for PCJ Online. Just about to push the button on another program from the media network Vintage Radio Archives.
By shortwave and satellite, this is Radio Netherlands. Media Network, a weekly survey of international communication developments, produced and presented by Jonathan Marks.
Right, hang on to your headphones, as a lot of last-minute news came in over the past few hours, which has changed our publicised lineup this week. We'll start for a change with listening suggestions. Hans van den Bogert in Veldhoven here in Holland reports that Radio-Télévision Marocain in Morocco has started relaying its international network on shortwave. Most of it is in French, and Hans has heard programmes from Rabat between 14 and 17 hours UTC on the frequency of 17.595 kHz. At 17 hours, they switch to 17.815 kHz until 19 hours, and then they move to 11.920 kHz for programmes right up until 01 hours UTC. The BBC Monitoring Service adds that English programmes from Morocco also form part of this new international service shortwave relay, and they're heard between 16.30 and 18 hours UTC, Mondays to Fridays. Saturdays, the block is later between 17 and 18 hours UTC, and on Sundays later still, between 19 and 20 hours UTC. Well, at 16.30 UTC yesterday on 17.595 kHz, we found two stations broadcasting in English on top of each other, the BRT in Belgium and Morocco. Have a listen.
The country's highest tradition of Hansi Body. Mr. Carlo Gibbs is an executive of the Hofstra Publishing Company, owners of the liberal at large newspaper.
Half an hour later, at 17 hours UTC, both stations leave 17.595, and it all goes quiet. There's shortwave logic for you. Despite the recent accord between the Nicaraguan government and the Contras, due to start on April the 1st, the US-backed Contra forces have no plans to discontinue their clandestine radio station. Radio Liberación, believed to be coming from the southern part of El Salvador, continues to operate. And a spokesman for the United Nicaraguan Opposition in Washington, D.C., told us yesterday they won't stop broadcasting towards Managua on medium wave just yet.
Not yet. I mean, depends what happened after 60 days, I would say.
To Europe, and the British Super Channel satellite TV service has approached its main rival, Sky, with a view to a merger. Sky Channel told us they're still studying the proposal, but no firm decision is expected very shortly. Both Super and Sky Channel have failed to make any money as yet, although Sky has always claimed that it takes a long time to make a profit in pan-European television. Sky, in fact, has just started an experimental breakfast programme in Swedish. When we switched on this morning at 04.30 UTC, they were doing some extensive morning exercises.
En, to, tre och upp av fåtöljerna.
Ja, hej allihop. Nu är dags för morgonjumpa med oss här från Friskis och Svettis. Och alla kan vara med, du också. Så vi startar med första övningen. Hoppar upp i soffan.
Oof, all that at 6.30 a.m. local time. Well, now to the United States, where the Navy has decided to move its relocatable shortwave over-the-horizon radar system to the Aleutian Islands. That's near the Alaskan mainland. In the course of 1989, the experimental radar system will move from its current site in White House, Virginia, to Amchitka Island. Meanwhile, the U.S. Air Force has a shortwave over-the-horizon radar system up in Maine, in the northeast corner of the U.S. Extensive tests of that system were made in January. Judging from monitoring reports, it seems to have performed without causing major interference problems to shortwave broadcasters. Ever since the Russian over-the-horizon radar system caused severe reception problems during its operation a few years back, concern has been expressed that these radars should find a modulation system that makes it compatible with other spectrum users.
Hey! Hey! You! You! Media Network's Car Radio Investigation.
Joining me for this part of the program is Pete Myers, because we often get questions as to whether there's a good car radio on the world market that has shortwave capability. The answer, in my humble opinion, seems to be not yet. A few years back, you could buy a shortwave converter from either the companies of Grundig or Becker, both West German, which you fitted between the car antenna and a standard car radio with a medium wave AM band. By pressing a button on the converter box, reception of medium wave was suddenly transformed into shortwave reception of, let's say, the 31-metre band. The converter has long since been discontinued. Grundig told us yesterday they have no plans to put such a device on the market again, and you'd be hard-pushed to find one on the second-hand market.
The converter device did a reasonable job, but tuning the dial was more by feel than anything else. You had to know by heart that Radio Netherlands was down the bottom end of the 49-meter band, and little bit to the right was the BBC and so on. Not much use to a novice. In addition, the placing of the car radio antenna was crucial. Put it too near the engine, and the radiation from either the mechanical or electronic ignition system drowned out all but the stronger shortwave broadcast signals.
The myth that shortwave on car radios is widely available in Europe seems to persist. If you have about $2,000, you can indeed buy one top model from each of Becker, Blaupunkt or Grundig that covers shortwave, of sorts. Two of the receivers cover the official 49-metre band only, whilst the Grundig does cover from 5.9 to 9.9 MHz. But that's a lot to pay for what's only a mediocre shortwave section in the set. Clearly the money in the top-range receivers goes into the FM reception and fancy tuning aids.
About 4 years ago, the Dutch Philips company launched their AC739 car radio stereo cassette player. This was much cheaper and offered two shortwave bands in addition to medium wave and FM. One band covers 3.5 to 12 MHz and the other 12 to 22 MHz continuously. But the single conversion set has only fair shortwave performance. The backlash on the tuning knob makes tuning somewhat haphazard. A lot of stations are crammed into a little space, and you could cause a nasty accident if you try to tune the receiver while driving at high speeds. Jamming and Morse interference leap out at you and can startle if you're not prepared for it. The set is still sold by Philips in Holland for $341. The trouble is, the purchaser isn't given much help as to what they can do with these two shortwave bands on the car radio. Even the current catalogue incorrectly informs the customer that the unit is designed to pick up wavelengths of between 13 and 75 millimetres.
So it was with interest at the end of January that the Japanese company of Kenwood launched their RZ1 wideband receiver onto the European market. This would cover continuously from 500 kHz way up to 905 MHz, so that's medium wave, shortwave, VHF, and way up beyond the UHF television bands here in Europe. We waited a few weeks and then went out and purchased an off-the-shelf sample at a shop in Utrecht. The price was 14.99 guilders, which is $832 at today's exchange rate.
Inside the foam packaging is an extremely light, compact, black-coloured receiver. It weighs 1,500 grams and looks exactly like a car radio. In fact, it will fit inside the standard hole drilled in the dashboard of most automobiles. If you do that, though, you'll end up with a tinny, muffled sound of less than 1.5 watts. The small speaker is mounted on the top of the set, and sliding it into a car radio rack, of course, prevents the sound from coming out. Kenwood sell a small mobile speaker to mount on top of the dashboard, but if you're driving at anything above 20 miles an hour in a standard car, the noise of the engine drowns out the mere 2 watts of audio power from the RZ1. If you're going to seriously use this receiver for mobile use, you'll have to use a car hi-fi booster amplifier. That's no problem, because on the back of the RZ1 are two phono connectors designed exactly for that purpose. Included with the instruction booklet are four plastic feet, So if you want the receiver to sit on top of a table, either at home or maybe on board a boat, that can be done. You need to find a 12-volt DC power supply from somewhere. The unit consumes just under 1 ampere of current when it's on, so a mains power unit or a car battery are essential. You can forget about trying to bank on penlight cells. That wouldn't last an hour.
Let's have a look at the front of the receiver. It's quite neat and uncomplicated. There's a rotary tuning knob, which has 24 steps per revolution, and which you can twist without banging your fingers on nearby control knobs. There's an on-off control, a squelch, and a row of buttons marked from 0 to 9. You can use these keys to directly enter a chosen frequency. And each time you press a key, the set beeps at you. The higher the number, the higher the bleep. So, how did the set perform below 30 megahertz?
Well, I'm afraid that despite its dual conversion circuitry, shortwave and medium wave performance on the RZ1 is simply disastrous. Using a simple car telescopic antenna mounted on the rear of the vehicle, we drove out into the countryside, some 60 miles from any medium wave transmitters. Parked by the side of the road, we tapped in 9410 kilohertz onto a shortwave portable receiver costing about $200. The BBC was coming in fairly weak, but readable.
Ring, and he swims to his beloved and climbs up on the balcony.
But while it is easy to be captured by the romantic quests of Lord Byron...
That was on a portable, with the whip antenna poking out of the window. So what did the same signal sound like on the RZ1? Well, the easy-to-read white display shows the same frequency, 9410 kHz, so let's turn up the volume. As you can hear, it's unusable. The rotary tuning knob moves the receiver frequency in 5 kHz steps on medium and shortwave. There is no fine-tuning control that you'd expect on any communications receiver.
The dynamic selectivity of the single intermediate frequency filter is so mediocre that if I select Swiss Radio International on 3975 kHz... Well, there they are, and now I move 5 kHz away... Well, as you can hear, side splatter all over the voice of Germany on nearby 3980 kHz. Between 3 and 30 MHz, the RZ1 has a very high background noise, this being mainly due to medium-wave mixing products. If you tune the medium-wave band at dusk, then apart from two strong clear signals around here, the rest of the band is filled with mush and distortion.
The RZ1 may be called a wideband receiver, but you'd expect it to select stations one at a time, not all at once. There is an attenuator to reduce the signal level coming into the receiver, and this helps slightly. But because they've put it at the back of the receiver, you can't reach the attenuator switch if you put the RZ1 in the dashboard of a car. The brochure indicates the receiver would be useful on a boat. Well, as it has both AM plus narrow and wideband FM modes, you could certainly use it to monitor local VHF traffic. But there is no single sideband on the RZ1, and undesirable second and third order harmonic products from the medium wave band obliterate most signals on the marine band above 1.8 megahertz anyway. For the shortwave broadcast and utility listener, you can get significantly better performance than this on a communications receiver costing two-thirds the price.
Mind you, the RZ1 covers frequencies well beyond the shortwave band. If you connect a wideband disc cone antenna, then you can start searching out the aircraft, utility, and even FM broadcast stations. You can even listen to FM in stereo via the external amplifier, but then any car radio will do that too. 100 memories are offered, together with four tuning rates of 5, 12.5, 20 and 25 kHz. These facilities are vital if you're scanning the huge areas above 100 MHz for local signals. A unique feature is the ability to mark certain frequencies with up to 7 letters or numbers, so that when they come up, you can actually see on the display your previously programmed identification. Performance on VHF and UHF is considerably better than shortwave, but it doesn't match the specifications of either the FRG 9600 from Yaesu or the ICOM ICR 7000, which are the main competing wideband receivers on the market.
To summarise, as far as the shortwave listener is concerned, the Kenwood RZ1 is definitely not a good choice. The luxury of having a radio in the car that gives you the entire shortwave band with digital readout is not matched by the performance or the price. Any cheap car radio will produce less distortion on medium wave than the 15% total harmonic distortion that we measured on the RZ1. You can also opt for a set with a cassette player too.
If you're looking for a VHF-UHF scanner, then check the competition. The RZ1 clearly covers a wider part of the spectrum at the expense of performance. Kenwood have a justifiably good reputation in the field of communications receivers. Their R2000 and 5000 models are deservedly popular. But the RZ1 is a terrible disappointment. Curiously, although the brochures talk about a US version with an NTSC decoder for television monitoring, Kenwood USA Corporation say they don't plan to market the RZ1 in the United States.
Radio Netherlands. It's hard for us to lose our identity.
And now it's time for a change of subject. A few weeks back, we carried an item on possible, and I stress possible, links between non-ionising radiation and certain types of skin cancer. Louis Slessin, editor of the New York-based Microwave News, has now sent us this follow-up.
An abnormally high rate of childhood cancer has been documented in the small agricultural town of McFarland in Kern County, Southern California. But despite years of intense study, health officials have been unable to identify the cause of the cancer cluster. Investigators had focused almost exclusively on chemical pollutants in the area without success. Nor can they explain why McFarland is different from the dozens of similar farming towns spread throughout the San Joaquin Valley. A number of experts, as well as some McFarland residents, now believe that the high-power Voice of America shortwave transmitter in nearby Delano may play a role in the cause of the cluster. The Delano VOA station, which is approximately 4 miles from the town of McFarland, has transmitters with nearly 2 million watts in total output, broadcasting radio programs to Asia and to Latin America. Three 250-kilowatt transmitters are used to broadcast southeast to Central and South America at 9 and 11 megahertz for approximately 4 hours each day, beaming programs directly over the nearby town. In a recent report on the cancer cluster, the California Department of Health Services states that it could not establish a link between any specific factor and development of the cancers. The state discounts the possible impact of radiofrequency radiation. Quote, "We don't think that the evidence that we looked at points in the direction of non-ionizing radiation as a problem at all," said Mr. Raymond Nutra, the head of the State Health Department's Epidemiological Studies and Surveillance Section. On the other hand, Dr. Ross Ady, Associate Chief of Staff for Research and Development at the Veterans Medical Center in Loma Linda, California, is not so sure. He's been following the McFarland investigation with keen interest and believes it is possible that the VOA radiation could have an effect. He points to the fact that there are no animal or human studies related to prolonged intermittent exposures at these levels. Other experts have raised the possibility of a connection between toxic chemicals stored near McFarland and the non-ionizing shortwave radiation in the air. Laboratory studies indicate that microwaves can enhance the carcinogenicity of certain chemical compounds. Work in California by Dr. William Fletcher has shown that weakly modulated radio frequency fields can significantly enhance chemical cancer promoters. Together, they disrupt communications between human cells through gap junctions. These findings are consistent with modern cancer models, which emphasize that this type of disruption leads to unregulated cell growth. However, it's very important to put this finding into perspective. We are exposed to all kinds of environmental health hazards in everyday life, even the ultraviolet radiation from the sun, which some people go to the beach to try and absorb. In the case of non-ionizing, low-level radiation from transmitter sites, a lot more research needs to be done. Those in this field of cancer studies are not trying to create mass hysteria. They're trying to ensure that sufficient scientific research is done in order to draw firm safety recommendations.
Radio Netherlands, the original international local radio station.
Now, joining me on a line from Vienna is Wolf Harrant. For a few weeks ago, we looked at Anglophone local radio in the south of France. Now, Austria, it seems, will license some private commercial local radio in 1989.
Yes, indeed, Jonathan. Probably beginning next year, Austria too will introduce private radio. As usual, this is due to a political decision, and some people get mixed feelings about it. Let's consider the facts. At a first glance, Austria, with its population of 7.5 million, seems to provide a good marketplace for commercial radio, for quite a lot of stations. But then, almost a third of our population is concentrated in the eastern part of the country, around Vienna, the national capital. This area might easily be covered with a few powerful FM transmitters. The central and western parts, however, are not only mountainous and thus quite difficult to be fully covered, they are also relatively sparsely populated. Local stations could hardly survive. You need regional cooperation to get financially off the ground. Moreover, ORF, the national radio, provides already a full range of programs. Take Vienna, for example. Here we get the cultural channel Österreich 1, the regional programs of between 3 and 5 provinces. There are 9 altogether, 1 for each province. And Ö3, the pop music channel, which in 5 of the 9 provinces provides additional local program windows. Finally, there is Blue Danube Radio in English, French and Spanish. To these 8 programs, you might add Radio Melodia, a middle-of-the-road music station in FM stereo from Czechoslovakia, Radio Danubius, the Hungarian holiday station in German, and Kossuth Radio Budapest with lots of good music, again in FM stereo. The situation is similar in the western parts of Austria, where a couple of German and Swiss ARD and private stations can be received. The south is a main target area for private stations from Italy. Radio Uno, to mention just one, provides 3 different channels in German, and there are stations from Yugoslavia as well. Audiences to all these cross-border programs are relatively small, even though Austrian private stations will meet heavy competition. Now let's take up another politically more important aspect. We have already one of Europe's strongest concentrations in the print media, with 2 dominating daily newspapers, the Kronenzeitung and Kurier. Between them, they share almost 70% of total audience. They and a few others with less circulation have now established a company to start Radio Print. The second largest concentration is in the south, where the 3 leading papers plan to introduce a station called Private Radio Carinthia. Now, it is widely feared that the political influence of only a few mass circulation papers might extend to the electronic media. No politician, it is argued, would then really dare to risk their unfavorable comments. The influence of the 4th establishment, critics say, will simply be far too strong. Okay, let's wait and see. Meanwhile, we have a minor sensation here in Vienna. Since October last year, a political pirate radio station critical to the government and the social situation in the Republic hit the airwaves. It took the authorities half a year to get hold of the transmitters of these pirates, or so they thought. Only a fortnight after final victory was announced, Radio Widerstand, or Radio Resistance, operated again on 103.3.
Radio Widerstand.
Radio Widerstand.
A A fortnight ago, their programs lasted for more than an hour and provoked authorities challenging the ORF and the postal authorities to confiscate their transmitter, which they did. Listen to the sudden end following Radio Widerstand's friendly invitation and Kossuth Radio popping up again on the frequency.
Für den schnellsten Postfuchs gibt es heute einen uralt UKW-Sender zu gewinnen. Diesen Veteran der freien Radiobewegung stellen wir gerne dem Postmuseum zur Verfügung.
Bis es soweit ist, hören Sie heute die Wiederholung unserer Sendung vom letzten Freitag.
Radio Widerstand.
Valamivel alacsonyabb szinten fog bekövetkezni, és valamivel korábban.
But a week later only, this Friday, the station was back again and promised to continue for the weeks to come.
Kleines Nachtgespräch über den Dächern Wiens.
Siehst du den Mond über Wien, Loisel?
Ja, Franz, aber den Sender nicht. Leicht einmal um.
And if my German is still any good, in that last interview they simply say they can see the moon above Vienna, but not the transmitter.
Africa Media News Desk.
And back on the line from Southern Africa is Richard Jinby.
The big news from Southwest Africa and Namibia is that the long-awaited evening transmissions of the SWABC's national service get underway on April the 5th. There will be two channels in operation between 1930 and 2100 hours UTC. That's 1930 and 2100. As far as shortwave is concerned, Channel 1, the educational and cultural service, will be carried on 3290 kHz, 3290, as well as medium wave 594 and 737 kHz. The entertainment service, Channel 2, will go out on 3270 kHz. At 2100, the two stations combine for the all-night service through until 0400 the next day, Sundays 0500. Turning to Angola, Radio Nacional in Luanda can now be heard on both 4820 and 4953. 4820 takes the B program and 4953 the A program. The Lubango regional station has two channels in operation, both on medium wave. 1232 kHz carries programs in vernaculars and 1313 kHz relays Luanda's A program. The clandestine station, A Voz de Resistencia do Galo Negro, operated on behalf of UNITA, has dropped their A channel, probably as a result of technical problems. Normally it is on 11980 and 15167 kHz. Those frequencies again, 11980 and 15167, from 0800 to 1000 and 1200 to 1400 hours. Radio Botswana has dropped 7255 kHz. This, I think, is because of problems at the transmitter. Until it went off the air, the signal had deteriorated badly. In Botswana, Radio Bop and Radio Mabatu are now 24 hours a day. Radio Bop is on medium wave, 1098 kHz. And lastly, Radio Mozambique has returned to 15295 kHz, where they heard around 0800 to 1500 hours. The frequency still varies somewhat, up to 4 kHz either side, and is poorly modulated.
Right, my thanks there to Richard Jinby.
The current propagation forecast is next from Media Network.
Now, I'm afraid we're having communications problems reaching Mike Bird in Melbourne, Australia, for this week's complete survey, but I can tell you that the current solar flux is 129 and the A index is active at a figure of 25. That means that conditions on the higher frequencies, around 15 and 17 megahertz, are disturbed. So it might be an idea to check for signals on the tropical bands of 60 and 90 metres for signals from the tropical regions of the world. These are less affected by the active geomagnetic activity. Last Saturday, there was a severe disturbance to transatlantic communications on shortwave here in Europe, but at the same time, paths to Asia opened up. The English broadcast from the Sri Lanka Broadcasting Corporation in Colombo, for instance, came booming through between 1745 and 1815 UTC on 11800 kHz. The outlook, it seems, over the Easter weekend is for continued low solar activity, but, I'm afraid, more disturbed geomagnetic activity. And finally, on this last day of March, an update on a non-appearance. We've been getting a lot of phone calls asking about the much-publicised 1988 International Listening Handbook, to be published by Bent Friedewald in West Germany. We were led to believe that it would be available at the end of this month. Well, nothing came in the post this morning, so we're left wondering, like many others, just what's going on. That's it for now. Join me on Easter Monday for our science review, the research file, and for the moment, have a peaceful weekend.
And that's where we end this nostalgic trip back into the Media Network audio archives from 1981 to October 2000. If you find all this stuff interesting, you might want to explore the Critical Distance website, where you can find more vintage audio shows, but also peruse recent video interviews I've made in the course of my travels around the world. Some of the videos actually follow up on points raised in the Media Network programme. So zip over to www.jonathanmarks.com for more details. In the meantime, this is Jonathan Marks saying back soon. Bye for now.